You're listening to Campfire Conversations, brought to you by Three Rivers Land Trust. Connected to the land, committed to conservation.
Man, ask for help, you help me.
Pitter patter.
Hey listeners, it's producer Brian. Wanted to let you all know that right now we're running an online end of year auction. We got some cool gear up there. We've got a couple of experiences, a turkey hunt, whiskey tasting, custom handmade paddles and fishing nets, and some fine jewelry. So if y'all are looking for a cool end-of-year gift for a significant other, or you're outdoorsman, give us a look.
And antique firearms.
That's true. Have you seen the picture of the 44 revolver?
Yeah, I looked at it. I'm still looking at whether I was going to place a bid on it. The only thing about it, I mean, it very well could have been carried by Jesse James. I mean, that's old school.
Yeah,
but
1890s.
The grip on it, it's a 44 mag, right? And the grip on it's so small, I feel like that joker would break your hand when you shot it. It's not the grip I'm looking for in a 44 mag, but it's a sweet gun. It'd be a sweet piece to, you know, put on display or have in your collection. I've really been eyeballing that LC Smith shotgun.
Yeah, that's pretty cool too. That'd be a cool mantelpiece as well.
Yeah, I got to fondle it at the Conservation Classic quite a bit.
I had it in my safe.
Yeah.
It was mine for like
a few years. You didn't hunt with it.
I know. It was mine. I went to a Facebook Marketplace meetup to try to get a stainless steel sink that got real sketchy.
I heard about that.
And I actually loaded a couple shells in there as I was pulling up because I had just picked it up.
Dude's ambushed.
Everything was fine. I actually didn't even go to the meetup. That's how weird it was. I don't want to talk about it, but...
They were trying to get him to meet up behind the grocery store in a
No, we were supposed to meet at the grocery store.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And then they called me, and they're like, I'm not feeling so well, so, like, come over to our warehouse. And I ended up driving over there, and it was, like, behind this chain-link wire fence, like, out in this real dark corner. And I was like,
I've seen this movie before.
Yeah, I was like, I called him back. I could hear a bunch of dudes on the other end of the line, and I ended up calling him back. I was like, you want to sell the sink? Meet me at where we said we were going to meet, or I ain't buying it. And they're like, no, just come on back. And they're like, we can't transport it. I was like, I know the dimensions of the sink. You can't put it in a car and drive it to the food line 5 minutes away? And they're like, nope. And I was like, all right, I'm out.
Well, to me, that's weird bait for like a victim. a stainless steel sink. Like, what kind of victim are they looking
to? I was desperate.
Nab with that. Like, you'd think they'd put up like, I don't know, a painting of, you know, a Da Vinci or something. And try to nab that person. But no, They're trying to get the dude that's working up meat on a stainless steel sink. What did they want with you? Strange.
My body.
Possibly.
Probably.
All right, so housekeeping. You good, Brian?
Yeah. I just wanted to make sure you saw this picture what I'm talking about. About the revolver?
Yeah, I saw it. I saw the goat. I also saw goat is not included if you look in the description.
I wanted the people to
What's the link to that?
I'm going to post it in the description because it's kind of a complicated URL, but okay. I'll post it in the description of the episode and on our social media.
Okay, sounds good.
So if you're a fan of auction, which I know you are, you should get on there and bid on this stuff. The jewelry, the firearms, the trips.
An engagement shoot provided by a very talented photographer.
There you go. So you should bid on it, bid early, bid often, and get yourself a prize. So... Moving on, today is a special day. We've got a special guest with us who we'll introduce in a minute. But first, let's have a little story time.
Before your story time,
go ahead.
I'm going to introduce Emily because I think it's going to tie into your story.
It your way.
So our guest today is Emily Shirey.
I know where you're going. Yep. Uh-huh. Go ahead. Yep.
And she's got a business training dogs out of Winston-Salem called Short Hairs and Shotguns. And Cody and I were talking before you came in, and Cody took his hat off. And I was like, oh, speaking of short hairs and shotguns, look at you, buddy, because you got a fresh cut.
Yeah, I got my ears lowered. So
go ahead and tell your story.
I was – so if you haven't, I'm sure you've saw some of the crazy pictures that Brian's put up of us recently. Whether it be our faces plastered on other people's bodies or otherwise, but my hair I was running COVID hair. It was long and hadn't had it cut but once last year, and I did it myself at that time. So it was getting long and unruly, and I was pretty much training my hair and like pulling it back under my hat and putting my hat on, just trying to teach it to go back and look cool. Well, it's not working out, according to my wife. She made a comment a couple of days ago that she was not a fan of the long hair. Well, I stewed on that comment all day. And this was in the morning time when she made the comment. And I stewed on it all day long and into the late evening. And I finally decided, you know what? She's right. I'm going to cut it. And so I came back in the house. She'd already put our son to bed. She's hanging out on the couch, you know, like you do in the evenings, kind of unwinding. And I was like, well, I'm going to go get a shower. So I go in the bathroom and break out the clippers and go to shaving my head and trimming up. Well, I start in the front. Of course, when you're cutting your own hair, you're going to start in the places you can see, right? And I'm sure everyone in here has cut their own hair. But anyway, so I'm cutting my hair, and I get to the back, and I'm like, you know what would be sweet? Mm-hmm. If I just kept a mullet. So that's what I did. I trimmed it up into the most perfect Joe Dirt mullet you've ever seen. I mean, Billy Ray Cyrus would have been proud.
Yadkin County waterfall.
It's a Yadkin County waterfall. That's right.
Yeah.
It was a neck blanket.
Yeah.
Business in the front, party in the back.
Yeah.
It was nice. And I kind of liked it. I was like, this I could get behind this look. And so I decided that it would be funny to go out and introduce myself to my wife with my new do. And so I come back out into the living room, and she's still at her perch on the couch. And I go sit down beside her, and I'm like, hey, honey, do you mind rubbing my back a little bit? And, you know, she doesn't even look up from what she's doing. Of course, she, you know, being a good wife and a good friend and good partner, she's scratching my back, and we're sitting there, and I'm like just waiting on her to notice and say something. Because I'm always, and she'll tell you this, I'm always like prodding her for a reaction to anything, like just messing with her, and she can't stand it. But anyways, this is going on for a good little bit, and she hasn't noticed or said anything, and I'm kind of like having a conversation with her, and she's still not noticed. And I was like, well, you know, I'm gonna turn on the light so I could see a little better, because you know we had the, you know, just like the lamp on, and so I turn on the overhead light, and we're still hanging out, and she hasn't noticed yet. And it's going on for a good bit of time, like more time than I'm willing to let it happen for. And so I look at her, and I'm like, honey, don't ever get on to me or get mad at me if I don't notice like a new haircut you've gotten or a new outfit that you wear, and like I don't say something about it. I was like, in the future, let's just know that that's off the table. You can't get on. And she's like, what? Have I got – uh-oh. Well, there's a party.
There's a drink.
Yep, that was my fault. We got ducks.
I'll take a sip.
I don't know anybody from Benton, Tennessee. I guarantee that somebody. Let me talk about the extended warranty on your vehicle. These people.
There's a Emily. There's a game. We don't bring it up that often. We used to bring it up a lot, but yeah, we had somebody ride in and say, "You taking a sip?" See that? We had somebody ride in and say every time back when we first started, and the whole show was like super unprofessional, obviously, which it still kind of is. Like, there was always cell phones ringing and, you know,
ambient noise, stuff going off, spilling coffee.
All the time. And we had somebody write in and say, every time I've started a new game that I play, that every time a phone rings or an email dings or whatever, I take a drink. And I'm going to tell you, I'm getting drunk listening to your show. So we still play the game here. We're drinking coffee and water and whatever. Yep. But if you're playing the real game, if you're playing the real game at home, be careful today.
Yep. All right. So back to this story. So I turn on this light, and I'm acting like I'm reading something, and I've told her, you know, don't ever call me out if I don't notice something about you. And she's like, why? Do I have something on my face? Like, so it's about her. Because she still hasn't noticed, and she's looking at me. Now, it is a Yadkin County waterfall, so it's in the back, but it's wavy and long. And I was like, honey. And I point to my head, and she's still looking. And I was like, notice anything different? Just anything at all? She's like, And at that point, I was like, this is it's pointless. She doesn't care. She does not care. She hasn't looked at me in the face in months. So I turned to the side, and she's like, oh, my God. What did you do? She's like, so that's what we're going with, huh? And just left it at that. And I was like, so you don't care? She's like, do what you want.
I see that it's gone.
She's like, how do you feel about it? And I was like, I kind of like it. Yeah. I was like, how do you feel about it? She's like, well, I'll rank it for you. She's like, prefer you clean cut, one. She's like, this is a way behind number two. And the long, long hair is way behind number three.
Yeah.
I was like, so you're saying I'm in the middle?
Yeah.
She's like, yeah. And I was like, well, I guess I'm going to run with it for a while. Well, yesterday I had to.
If you can hear the phone ringing.
Yeah.
There's another, by the way.
Yesterday I had to be a part of a commercial for the TDA, Rowan County Tourism. Just kind of a thing we got volunteered for. So I felt like maybe I wouldn't be representing Rowan County in the best light with a fresh mullet.
Yeah.
So
that's a good call.
Needless to say, no mullet.
That's right.
Clean cut. So short hairs and shotguns, I fit right in with the pups that you're training. So
with the theme of
the
today.
Theme.
Yes.
So Emily, let's move along and introduce yourself to any extent you feel and deem appropriate, and tell us a little bit about your business, and then we'll just start asking questions.
Okay. Well, thank you guys so much for having me on. I'm Emily. I'm the owner of Short Hairs and Shotguns. I have a small business in Winston-Salem, and I primarily train companion gun dogs. So basically gun dogs that are going to be in the house, first and foremost family pets, but also might go hunting on occasion or more often than your average companion dog. But what sets my business apart is that I keep all my client dogs in my house. So a huge part of that is going to be basic obedience, such as, you know, not counter surfing, a lot of place work. So being calm and stable in the house, which isn't prioritized enough, in my opinion, for bird dogs. So a lot of people think you either have a pet or you have a hunting dog. And that's a subject that's near and dear to my heart because my dog is first and foremost very much a pet. She sleeps in bed with me, and I'm rarely without her. So she is very much a pet and also a super competitive hunting dog as well. So I like to kind of push that companions can be hunting dogs and hunting dogs can be companions, and you don't have to have one or the other. So that's what my business kind of focuses on. I also do some basic pet obedience, but in general, I really like the aspect of the companion hunting dog. I work closely with Grayson Geyer at Lost Highway Kennels, who you guys are very familiar with.
Hey, Grayson.
Grayson's a great guy, and so we do all of our field work together. So he has some different kinds of gun dog programs that are a little bit unique compared to mine, and we do a lot of our training together. So that's essentially my business.
Cool. How did you know Grayson before you got into the bird dog world, or did you meet him through the bird dog world?
I met Grayson through the bird dog world. I met him in the fall of maybe 2018. I met him at a little seminar event called Upland 101, and it was a super, super great event that there was a bunch of people involved in that, and the Wildlife Commission and Stephen Faust with Stony Brook Gordon Setters, and then Grayson had a part in that as well. And it was a super neat event for essentially people wanting to get into upland bird hunting but didn't know where to start. And it was super helpful. They talked about, you know, what to look for hunting wild birds in North Carolina, and, you know, safety and how to scout locations and different kinds of apps and equipment. And it was really, really neat little seminar. And I had just gotten my first bird dog and had pretty much only done stuff through NABDA, which is the North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association. So more of a testing organization versus wild bird hunting. So right. I met Grayson there, and then started working with him shortly after that in the spring of 2019. And I started working with Grayson through just taking lessons with my personal dog. And it kind of evolved into, at the time, I was just a pet obedience trainer, training, you know, mostly just pet dogs. And it kind of evolved into this different program where I could have that pet obedience side of things and work with more bird dogs as well, which which I much prefer.
Upland 101, I imagine. So today is Wednesday.
What day is today?
Wednesday, December 9th. And tomorrow is Thursday, December 10th, which is opening day of woodcock season in North Carolina. And I imagine that, like, this morning, you very easily, during the night, sleeping with your fresh cut, you could have had a nightmare about Upland 101.
When she was saying it, I was smiling, but deep down I was like, how do I make that event not happen ever again? No, I'm seriously joking.
He's, yeah, Cody being a avid upland hunter, the prospect of new people getting into it and learning
it's terrifying
tricks
and exhilarating all
and
the same
all
time.
The tricks and trades that lead to excellent upland bird hunters in the area, I'm sure frightens you.
It's funny that you mentioned Stephen Faust with Stony Brook. I'm actually meeting up with those guys either tonight or tomorrow. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, they got a big woodcock camp planned.
Oh, awesome. So, that'll be fun. I'm jealous.
Yep, I'm going to go try to send them to all the decoy places so they, yeah. don't, so they don't go to the right place.
Good luck with Stephen, at least.
Yeah, no, he's a great guy, great bird dog hunter, bird dog guy. So, yeah, so anyways, yeah,
I'm interested in, so we talked about how you met Grayson, but you grew up in Ohio.
Correct.
And you, I guess, became interested from what I've read in animals and animal psychology through horses. Is
correct.
That right?
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Talk a little bit about your backstory.
So I started taking riding lessons when I was 3 and got my first horse when I was 6. And so all growing up, I was very much a horse girl, and that's pretty much all I did for a really long time. I actually only recently sold my horses to move to Kansas to do bird dog things. But my whole life was pretty much revolved around horses. So I have a degree in animal sciences because I wanted to do horse things. And I've always had dogs as pets, but never thought of them in the same way I would as horses, which is, you know,
the training
aspect and the competing horses. And I was very involved in that. And then had absolutely 100% pet dogs that I didn't do any kind of training with or really know much about. And it wasn't until, I moved to North Carolina in 2015 and then got a job working for a pet obedience company in 2017. And it wasn't until then where I saw all these really cool working and competition dogs that I was like, oh, wow, this is very much like horses, but just a little bit different.
Yeah, what are some of the similarities and differences between the psychology of horses versus dogs and things that you notice that are similar in training them and things that are different?
So that's a great question. First and foremost, horses are prey animals and dogs are predators. So when working with horses, you have to be very cautious of that. And it's a whole different psychology in working with a prey animal because you can't use some of the tools we use in dog training quite as easily, and that's always has to be in the back of your mind that, you know, their instincts are to run. Mm-hmm. And especially with them being so big, that's always something to keep in mind. And, you know, that's another huge aspect of the difference in training horses and dogs. You know, if the dog won't get in the car, you pick it up, put it in the car. The horse won't get in the horse trailer, you don't pick them. Well, you can't pick them up and put them in the trailer. So, you know, learning how to work with horses is, I think, has been a huge benefit in my dog training career versus going from dogs to horses, going from horses to dogs. I've learned a lot on how to get horses to want to work with you because you really don't have an option. You can struggle with them all you want. You can fight with them all you want, but you're not going to get anywhere as long as the horse doesn't want to do it.
Right.
So it's really impacted my dog training for sure because, you know, you can pick the dog up and put him in the car, but if you can work with him and make it his idea, you're going to have a lot more success.
Yeah, I think it would be weird to go the other way, to go from dogs to horses because, like you said, you could really mess up, you know, going with a predator animal such as a dog where you can be a little more heavy-handed and have these tactics of control and maybe forceful because you're bigger than they are.
Yep.
going to a horse where you kind of got to, you know, you got to be gentle with them because they're a prey animal and their instinct is flight and run, but also they can kill you.
Certainly.
So, yeah, that is a good point. I never really thought of it that way. Interesting. So have you ever thought of combining the two passions of equestrian and and canine together and
people
becoming a tally-ho type hunter?
Well, people ask me all the time why I don't do horseback field trials. Mm-hmm. And that's a very valid question, and I absolutely should be and probably will be one day. But as any horse person knows, they are extremely expensive and extremely time-consuming, and that's really, really the reason why I'm not right now. But one day for sure. I miss horses a lot, and I will definitely be back into them at some point. But for right now, dogs take up all of my time and money.
Yeah, I understand that. I had horses myself for quite a long time.
Oh, awesome.
But I don't know that I'm looking to get back into horses. I think I feel like I got out of horses and I'm better off.
Most people
I've thrown around the idea of mules. I've not had mules. I don't know anything about mules. My dad doesn't care for mules. That's why we never had them. We always had horses. But I've thrown out the idea that I think having a mule would be cool. But I don't know. I don't know that I want to get back into a giant four-legged beast.
Still time-consuming and expensive.
Expensive, yeah. And it's just a lot of clean. You think cleaning up after a dog's bad.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
All right.
A lot of work.
I've been reading your website, and I have a list of things that I want to ask about. If I go out of order or you have something to pop in your head, you go off on any tangent you want.
Sounds good.
I'll start off with a tie to me. As I've talked about on the show, I bought a house. I've been working on the house. I think the next logical step for me is
a horse.
is a mule.
Yeah.
I'm definitely kind of even buying the house. Part of my thought was I need to have my own place and then I can get dogs. It's something I've been thinking about a lot. So I've been reading your website, and if you're like me and you're looking to buy a dog or you're looking for a companion hunting dog, there's a lot of great resources on there that I've been kind of perusing through, and I just read your whole section on puppy 101 stuff. So, which is super helpful and kind of led me. But one of the things that was in there was, I think the first step was, even before your purchase, identifying what you're looking for in a dog, how there's this mantra that dogs are a product of the trainer, but you kind of somewhat disagree with that, and that there is a component of genetics.
For
and
sure. Absolutely.
And that's important. So if you're going out, you're looking for a dog, how do you identify, all right, this is the dog for me?
Great question. So for me, starting with your purpose and then finding the right breeder is going to be the way to go. So what do you want that dog for? There seems to be this general idea, which I like to squash, that all dogs within a breed are very similar or created equal. So people go, okay, GSP's for me. Now I'm going to go buy the first one I see. And that couldn't be any further from the truth. So as Grayson always says, and I always like to repeat, there's as much variation within breeds as between them. So you can find, you know, a very high energy wild GSP, which is what they mostly are, but we've seen plenty of GSPs who are lazy and lack desire and don't want to get off the couch. And so if you were looking for one or the other and end up with the opposite, it's not going to be surprising. So finding the right breed is just kind of the first step and just kind of the tip of the iceberg. So, you know, a good place to start if you are looking for a hunting dog, do you want a Flushing dog or do you want a Pointing dog? And that's a very easy kind of way to go about it. And then, you know, going from there, do you want a dog to hunt in cold weather and cold water? You know, a GSP is not ever really going to be my recommendation if you only want a duck hunt. So figuring out what your purpose is and kind of narrowing down your options from there. I always think it's a good idea to kind of have a few breeds that you particularly like. And then my biggest recommendation is to always visit breeders, spend time with breeders, spend time with their dogs, do what you want to do with those. So if you want to go duck hunting, go find a really nice lab breeder and go duck hunting with them. You know, I realize that's not an option for everyone because of location and those kinds of things, but spend time with their dogs and make sure that their temperament and, you know, all the qualities you're looking for and the purpose you want are there. So, you know, if you want a big ranging wild field bred, you know, field trial type GSP, go watch field trials and see those dogs run. Or if you want a, you know, dog to do NAVDA with, go to a NAVDA event and, you know, see which ones you like, find out where they got those from, where they got their dog from, and visit that breeder and so on. But there's so much that goes into it, and so much of it is genetics, that I think that you'll find the most success and be the happiest if you spend your time researching particular bloodlines and kind of, you know, finding the breeder that's right for you versus just the breed.
I got a question. So Cody's got his Boykins, which are great flushing dogs for upland. I've hunted with his dogs waterfowl hunting. They're excellent waterfowl hunters. I've kind of got it in my mind that I want a lab.
Okay, that's a great choice.
But I'm interested, and I've been doing research.
It's the most popular choice in America.
I know, yeah. But I've been doing research on the use of labs for upland hunting, mm-hmm. for woodcock bee or grouse hunting or whatever, and I found some pretty promising stuff about people using labs for upland stuff. Not obviously, maybe not to the degree. I found a lot more about Boykins. Found a lot more information about pointers, but is there a problem with trying to take a lab and have a waterfowl dog, a wetlands dog, and an upland dog?
Absolutely not. And, you know, we have these versatile hunting breeds, which a lab is not one of them, but if you ask Grayson, for sure, he's going to tell you the most versatile dog he has is a lab. Mm-hmm. And plenty of people do upland hunting with them, and they do not have to point in order to be great sure. upland dogs. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people are really having fun pheasant hunting with them, mm-hmm. and I've seen plenty of people hunt grouse and woodcock with them as well. In particular, I love hunting a pointing dog with a flushing dog. I mean, that there's no better way to go about it, in my opinion. That doesn't mean either aren't great on their own, but now that we've been hunting with our pointing dogs with Grayson's lab, I don't think I can ever go back to not hunting like that. Mm-hmm. It just makes the most sense to me.
Yeah. And I guess on the flip side of that, which through your social media stuff that I've seen and your website, obviously the flip side is true too, because I've seen your GSPs going and retrieving ducks for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, talk about your experience with taking your pointing dogs and using them for cold weather stuff and wetland stuff.
Okay, so the majority of the versatile stuff I do is through NAVDA, which is a versatile hunting dog association. A huge part of that is not only the field work, but there's a lot of water work in that as well. And GSPs can absolutely do super well with that. But I will tell you right now, they do not handle the cold like a lab will. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just not built for it. And so my dog hates a duck. She thinks her sole purpose in life is to kill all of the ducks, and there's nothing she would love more to, you know, be a super serious duck hunting dog, but she just cannot do the cold water. Mm-hmm. Absolutely can't. And, you know, part of that's me. She sleeps under the covers every night, so she is certainly not conditioned to cold water and cold weather. You know, I kind of am not either. But there are plenty of dogs out there that, you know, short-haired dogs out there that duck hunt and do it well. But you've got to have, for one, the right dog. There are a lot of short-haired dogs that have no desire to retrieve or no desire to step foot in water. So, again, if you are really interested in duck hunting a short hair, you need to find one who duck hunts and, you know, buy one from that breeder or that litter, because there are plenty out there that will not have any interest in that.
I'm hogging the mic. Is that okay?
Carry on, my friend. Right,
good. Okay. The next step with, you know, you do your due diligence. You find the breeder that you want. You find the breed that you want. You make a purchase. The one thing that I'm fearful of or concerned with is, after reading your website and reading other things, puppies for a long time take a lot of commitment, a lot of time.
Absolutely.
And for somebody who works 9 to 5, 8 to 5, fortunately, I bought this house that's closer to work, a lot closer to work than I was before, which was intentional. But when it comes to crating that dog and giving it the attention that it needs throughout the day, especially in those critical first 4 months.
Yep.
How does that tie in with somebody who has a job and has to go to the office and things like that? And how can you manage that properly? Can you manage that well?
Yeah, for sure. So puppies obviously need to be let out frequently. So my first and foremost, my biggest recommendation for anyone getting a puppy is crate train it. And I get a lot of people who go, okay, I want to crate train, but then my puppy screamed and cried all night, so I let it out. Mm. Your puppy's going to scream and cry all night. And some will scream and cry worse than others, but you have to keep up with it. So that is my first recommendation. You got to stay strong.
Yeah.
They do need to go out, you know, every few hours. And so if you can run home at lunch, you're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. Should they be in a crate from 8 to 5 every day? No, you're going to struggle with that the first couple weeks. But that being said, they need to spend a lot of time in their crate. They're, you know, especially with COVID, there's been this idea that puppies should be out all the time with us and we should be constantly entertaining them. And it's sad if we have to put our puppy in a crate. And that is such a huge misconception because puppies need to be crate trained in order to be potty trained well. That is the majority of potty training comes from preventing accidents. And we can prevent accidents by keeping them in small crates where it's not, you know, it's not reinforcing for them to potty in their crate. But they also need that time away from us, that time being bored, that time building frustration. So, you know, just like kids, if we cater to them and give them everything they want, at some point when they become frustrated, so let's say you're traveling to go hunting and you have to crate your dog, it's, you know, that's the way it works. They have to know that they can survive that and that they can cope with that. Yep. And so it starts when they're puppies, you know. Spending time in a crate on their own is so important, and that's so overlooked by the idea that they're baby humans and we constantly need to cater to them. So spending a lot of time in their crate is going to be fine, but they obviously need to go out regularly to go potty.
So there's nothing wrong with getting up, say I leave my house at 8:30, getting up at 6:30, taking the dog out, letting it go to the bathroom, giving it some time to play, taking it out again, putting it in the crate, going to work, coming back at lunch, and then working again for the rest of the day, coming back at 5 and doing the process over again. That gap, that time gap from 8:30 to noon and then 1 to 5, that's okay?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the benefit of that is you're creating this expectation that they aren't going to be entertained all day, because that's going to be life with you, right? You're never going to just be home all day hanging out with them. So if you, you know, set those expectations from the get-go that you spend a lot of time in your crate during the day, that's going to help them handle that transition later. The other option is, I know I offer a puppy program. Grayson offers a puppy program. There are quite a few trainers in the area that offer a puppy program. And for me, what that looks like is it's generally a 2-week program. They come and stay with me for 2 weeks. And in those 2 weeks, we'll work on crate training and potty training a lot, but it's also super important for socialization. Mm-hmm. So in general, the critical socialization period cuts off around 16 weeks, and that can vary between dogs and breeds. But what that means is up until that 16 weeks, anything and everything you can socialize your puppy with, you should. And that's not just people or dogs. It's, you know, textures, surfaces, noises, environments, grooming, bathing, you know, going to the vet, anything and everything you can socialize your puppy with, you should try to do it before 16 weeks.
And something that I read on your site was not only doing it, the socializing, but doing it well.
Yeah.
Like making it, and by that, I mean making it a comfortable positive experience for them. Because you can expose them to all these, you know, take them to the dog park where they're getting ganged up on by a bunch of big dogs, and it's, you know,
right, that's
it's
terrifying.
Doing the actual opposite of what you're trying to do, which is make them comfortable.
Exactly. So in my puppy program, my goal is to create really positive socialization experiences. You know, I've got a lot of really well-adjusted, appropriate dogs. You know, I've got a lot of access to different kinds of places. You know, what you don't want to do is take your unvaccinated puppy to a dog park where, you know, there are plenty of safe places to take a puppy where, you know, I don't recommend dog parks or pet stores where there's going to be a bunch of other dogs, but, you know,
rest stops, anywhere there's other dogs
exactly,
you don't know.
Right. Yeah. You know, but taking your puppy to something like Home Depot or Lowe's when they're dog friendly is a great place to take a young puppy to, if you feel like they're ready for that, to hear different noises, see people, the slick floors in there. So when I do that, I always take a hungry puppy who hasn't eaten and then take kibble with me, and I feed them their meals throughout the store and making sure that, you know, they're focused on me and not being, you know, worried about the environment. But that's part of the puppy program is I realize people with full-time jobs, you know, may not have access to all those different opportunities. So that's something to look into as well. If you have a puppy and you want to make sure that they're properly socialized, finding a program like that will help.
Like yours.
help the potty training process as well.
That's a good pitch.
Yeah, I think that I couldn't agree more with anything you said. Now, I'm not a professional trainer by any means. I've got my own dogs and, of course, take care of those dogs. But, yeah, the kennel training thing, that's – I think if you take away anything from this entire podcast, that's something you could take away as a new dog owner is crate training.
Yep, stay strong.
Yeah, stay strong. And that – I found, and correct me if I'm wrong, Emily, but what I found in crate training, my older dog, she's got a very strong personality to the point where she's kind of her own person type thing. And I know you've ran into those dogs before that are, you know, they've got their ideas of how things are going to go.
For sure.
And it's usually not what your idea of how things are going to go is. But what I found, even, and she did that from 7 weeks, she was like that.
Oh, my goodness.
But what I found was that crate training, that time apart, and her being bored made it so much easier for me to get her to do the things I wanted to do because at least she was getting to come out and play.
Absolutely.
And so I actually, no toys in the
yep.
kennel, nothing. Like, you were going to be bored for this time. I felt bad. Like, I felt like I was putting her in jail, you know. But it's like you said, they're not humans, and they need that time apart. And if they were dogs in the wild, they would be in a whole half their time, you know, they would be in a situation where they're in a den.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. And I found that it definitely helped in my training process. And I didn't have somebody great like you to tell me that. I just had to figure it out and, you know, read books from the 60s. So, which those books are good. And a lot of that stuff still rings true. So
you match the crate. Do you like upgrade crate size? I think, from something I read on your website that, you know, you start off with 24 by 24 or so, real small.
Yep.
And that's is the purpose of that. So basically, I mean, it sounds bad. You don't want to give them space to go to the bathroom and then get away from where they've gone to the bathroom.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yep. So typically I start with and I mostly have bigger dogs. It might be different for something like a Boykin, but typically I start with a 24-inch crate and then I slowly move up as the puppy outgrows that. So you obviously don't want them to be uncomfortable
sure.
in it, but they should not have enough room to potty and then go lay somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they potty in there and then they're in it, chances are that'll help prevent them from pottying in mm-hmm. it again.
Yeah.
And that's super important because if you put a small puppy in a big old crate, you'll have the worst, or, you know, people who don't crate train, I don't know how they ever potty train their dogs. Because as long as they're able to potty and get away from it, there's really not a whole lot of incentive for them to hold it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish there was a way to train humans like that. I've got a 2-year-old. Doesn't work that way. Like, he's like, ready to change my diaper now, Dad. I'm like, son, when you're telling me like that, it's time to be a big boy. hey, Dad, how about topping off my juice?
Yeah.
And change my tongue. But no, it's we're working on I started to say crate training my boy, but no, potty training. So it's I feel like with Grace and I kind of laughed about this earlier, but training dogs is easier than humans.
I can imagine. I don't have a lot of experience in that aspect, but
I prefer to train puppies. it's tough, but. What else you got, Sam?
All right. Yeah, can I keep going?
Yeah, let me clarify one thing while I'm interrupting
Please.
Here. So just for the listener who may not be as deep into the dog world as you are, and I'm not, GSP, German Short-Haired Pointer.
Oh, thank you.
So she obviously short hairs and shotguns, so she's into GSPs.
Yes, thank you.
Which is the German Short-Haired Pointer. There's a lot of different variations of pointer. The GSP being one of the most versatile and popular breeds.
So before we hop back into questions, let's do an ad real quick for our friends over at Backcountry and Beyond.
Man, I went over there. I went over there Thanksgiving week. No, it was maybe the weekend or maybe it was the week. I don't remember. It was right around. They had a killer sale. So if you missed out on that sale, and it's probably our fault for not telling you, but unbelievable. I walked out of there with $250 worth of stuff for $60.
Mm.
Unbelievable. Black Rifle Coffee. I got socks. The fit socks were 30% off, so you missed out. I stocked up for woodcock season. I'm good to go.
I think the moral of the story is you should just be going over there once every couple of weeks and just seeing what they got going on, because they always have sales.
And have you got any of their marshware, their new apparel line they're carrying?
No, not yet.
Ben's running a bunch of it.
I have.
I'm wearing it.
Yeah, a strapping guy like that.
You're gonna notice.
Of course, he's wearing the finest.
That is
the
underscore drifter underscore life.
Oh my God. Okay, thank you. Okay, yeah, marshware.
I mean, backcountry and beyond.
It makes me want to go get some for sure.
Ben's modeling around town.
Yeah, of course he is. Ben sent me a text a while back. Actually, I went and borrowed a climber from him. That got eaten up on by squirrels. He had left it outside, and the squirrels had eaten the fabric off the seat and stuff. And
he's like, yeah, you can take this one. It's a piece of crap.
But I borrowed it because I'm taking a friend out this week hunting, and we're going through the basics and everything and hopefully get his first deer. So I went over to his house and happened to see his old cat, Fox. Now, Fox was...
That's super confusing. His old cat named Fox.
His old cat named Fox. It looks like a fox. Great cat. I had met Fox. So hang with me. This story's hilarious. I had met Fox when I had gone over to his house for something. And he's like, I'll be back in a little bit. Y'all just hang out in the house. And as I was going in the door, Fox was standing right there and acted like he'd done this 100 times. So I let him in, and we were just sitting on the couch hanging out together. And he comes in, he's like, what is Fox doing in here? And I was like, he's not an inside cat? He's like, no. And I was like, he acted like he belonged in here. He came straight to the couch, just had been hanging out. He's like, well, that's just him. And he was a great cat. Well, Fox is actually an outside cat, and for like a month, Ben didn't see him. He was gone. And then some friend of his calls him and is like, hey, Fox is living over at this guy's house. And, like, the guy had fallen in love with Fox, and Fox had been hanging out, and he was, like, sleeping with Fox and stuff. His neighbor had, like, basically taken him and had been, like, asking, like, eventually, like, started asking about, hey, is he vaccinated and stuff like that? Could Facebook message Ben and ask him about, like, the health history of the cat and stuff?
No, he's actually got rabies. It's cool that you're sleeping with him, though.
So I saw Fox around the neighborhood as I was going over there to pick up the climber, and I texted him and said, I saw Fox. He was walking down this road, and he said, well, Fox is a drifter now. And I said,
the underscore drifter underscore Fox.
So long story short, but that
Ben,
was funny.
Ben, shame on you for letting a cat run loose.
Mm.
Shame.
That cat's living inside with somebody else.
They're telling how many woodcock that cat has eaten.
Well, that's not even his cat anymore. It's been abducted. All right, back to questions for you, Emily. So one thing that
that was the worst commercial ever. Backcountry and Beyond has nothing to do with stray cats or drifting cats. Go there to purchase your marshware, your Black Rifle coffee, your Garmin equipment. They've got the Garmin Alphas, so for dog training.
That's something I want to ask you about.
They can get that stuff for you and walk you through how to use it. So, yeah.
That's a great segue, too, because I am going to ask about gear.
Back to you.
Thanks. Backcountry and Beyond is in Salisbury, by the way. It's right off of the intersection of 85.
He's trying to make up.
At Industry. I am. Jeff. I feel bad. Jeff, I'm sorry.
He's trying to make up for
Jeff,
that.
I'm so sorry. Located in downtown Salisbury, right off of the intersection of 85 and Ennis Street. And you can go to backcountryandbeyond.com as well if you don't want to go to the store. But they keep everything safe in the store and treat you right there as well. So, all right, let's move on. Since Cody so eloquently set me up, let's talk about gear. I saw that you have the Garmin that Cody was talking about that you can get to Backcountry and Beyond. But talk about some of the pieces of equipment that have kind of changed the game for you as you've gotten into this world and what makes them so good.
Okay, so starting with the Garmin, I use the 550 Pro Plus, which has the tracking feature on it. I particularly like that. I actually just bought an Alpha as well, but I love the 550 Pro Plus for tracking and training. So essentially anytime my dogs are out, they're being trained as well. So the 550 Pro Plus is great for Knowing where they are, which has been especially important in woodcock cover. Mm-hmm. Actually, just
that's right.
Last weekend I was scouting an area, and it it said once you get once you're within 20 feet of the collar, it doesn't tell you which direction they are. It just says you're 20 feet away, and I still couldn't find my dog. But it has a little beep noise on it too, which helps for direction. But the, having that tracking is has been really useful for woodcock cover especially, but it's a nice training collar as well. So that's something I definitely recommend, especially if you have a big ranging dog or you're going to be hunting public land. I would always recommend some kind of tracking collar, whether that's that, you know, the Astro and then use or, you know, the Alpha, but the 550 Pro Plus is definitely my preference for training as well.
Explain the interface on that. So you have a screen that has basically a compass on it that points in the direction where your dog is. How does that work?
Yeah, so the 550 Pro Plus, at the bottom, it just it tells you an area or an arrow in the direction they are and then the yards that they are away. So the Alpha is the big orange handset, and that has like satellite, so you can see where you are in relation to them.
That's yeah, a full-on GPS.
Yeah,
and imagery and everything.
And mm-hmm. it, you know, it tells you all sorts of different statistics, like how far the dogs went and different things. So the 550 Pro Plus is just there. There's the 550 Pro, which does not have the tracking on it. Mm-hmm. It's just the training collar. The Plus has the tracking on it, and that just tells you in which direction they are and how many yards away. And that one, you can put three collars on, so you can see where you're. Three dogs are the Alpha is something.
Yeah, it's 20 something
crazy.
Dogs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of like lion hunters and bear hunters and
yeah.
coon dog guy. I mean, it's for every mm-hmm. every dog you can think of.
Okay,
you can do it
for sure.
I got a question for you about the Pro Plus. So my gripe with the Alpha and the Astro is that once you get multiple collars on there, you lose function on the exterior buttons. And so my thing is when I'm either needing to train or correct a dog, or if I need to beep them, you know, or give them stimulus, I like to have that button on the, I don't need to be touching a touch screen, because I don't look at my right. handset when I'm yep. walking. So what have you, as the Pro Plus, does it have just a physical button and you've got it for multiple collars and you don't need
exactly. So yeah. that's why you'll find that most trainers use the Pro Plus.
That's what
the
I
Alpha
thought.
Is really not for training.
So I'm
and that's,
writing that down because I didn't know that.
I'm getting it just for to pair. So you can pair both of them together. So you can run the 550 Pro Plus and the Alpha at the
okay.
same time. So it's cool to have that satellite, but really if you're really training your dog at all, the 550 Pro. So there's a toggle that goes between each of the three collars, and it's very simple to move. And then mm-hmm. it's there's vibrate, and then six stimulation levels, and then there's low, medium, high within each six of those. You know, it's pretty standard, but it's easy to, you know, where the Alpha, if you want to change the stimulation level, you've got to do some
yeah,
work.
You got to get in there.
It's not uh-huh. practical sure. at all. It's not practical, whereas the yep. 550 is much
yeah,
more
it,
practical.
It was. I think it was invented for houndsmen.
For sure. Absolutely.
And bird dog folks have really figured out how to adapt it to their use and do well with it, especially if you run in just one dog or two.
That's
but,
different.
But I think once you get above one dog with that one, it's a little janky to get in there and start changing stuff.
Definitely not the best option.
I did not know about the Pro Plus as far as it had the tracking the way it does, as well as the exterior buttons. I'm in the market, so
yep, it's a good one.
I've ran, and you can feel free to tell me how you feel about it. I've been running the Sport Dog Wetland Hunters, that line of collar. I think it's the 825 or whatever, Sport Dog SD825.
I haven't worked with Sport Dog much. So in general, for my basic obedience, so if I'm not running a dog in the field, I put an eColor Technology Mini Educator on them,
mm-hmm.
which is what I used for pet obedience. And so it's what's comfortable for me, and it has 100 stim levels. And I really like the, you know, the degree that you can find the dog's lowest working level. So I use that like 90% of the time,
okay.
and then when I'm in the field, I throw the tracking collar on. But sure. if I'm, you know, walking somewhere or doing obedience at home, I use my eColor Technology Mini Educator.
Okay, okay. Yeah, well, Sport Dog, I feel like it's very similar to that one.
Most of them are pretty similar.
The variation of stimulation levels. It's only got, I think, well, it's got three ranges, low, medium, and high, and then seven levels within those ranges.
Oh,
so
gotcha.
Whatever the math is on that, I don't know. It's more than 21. It is 21.
It's 21.
Three times seven is 21. Yep. It is 21. Yep, plus a vibrate, so it's more than 21.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back to gear. Clicker.
Yes. Absolutely.
That's a big piece of gear that you use.
Yep.
Really? So okay, I'm interested in this. I don't do this.
Especially with puppies. I love using the clicker for puppies. So I do a lot of free shaping, which is where you know, you get your puppy to offer certain behaviors and then you build upon that. So, you know, if you want them to go to place and sit down, you might start with them looking at place and then you reward that. And then if they move towards place and you reward that. I love free shaping because I think it builds a dog that is really engaged and really wants to work, which is super important for me personally, especially with my personal dogs. I want a dog that's constantly pushing me to do things. And when you utilize that free shaping, they start to become really creative and really engaged. And they, you know, are always kind of wondering what's next. What can I do to get some food from you? So I love using that. Clicker is great for so many reasons other than just free shaping, though, especially if you've got a young puppy. You know, what the clicker is it's a marker, so it lets them know that food is coming. And so the reason why we use a clicker is because it helps us with our timing. So if you're trying to teach a puppy to sit, you can click as soon as their butt hits the ground, which is going to be more appropriate timing than if you try to give them a piece of food immediately.
Okay.
For that sit.
I get it. Yep, that makes sense.
So, you know, anytime I teach something new, I use it. Anytime I'm looking to clean up a behavior, I use it. So it's something that I use even with my older dogs, too, to continue to teach new things. Or, you know, if something's getting a little sloppy and I want to go back and clean something up, make it a little bit more precise, I bring my clicker back out. But I love using the clicker for
that. Makes sense. It's an immediate response to behavior that you like. So when
it's
they
immediate reinforcement. So it's telling them that the reinforcement is coming, so they know at the precise moment when they did
the right thing. Yep. Yeah, mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yep.
For somebody who's not in the world like y'all, when you're saying looking at space.
Oh, I don't think I'm in the world like she is.
Okay. All right. You were saying when talking about free shaping?
Yep.
You said when they look at space.
Look at place.
Place.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Explain that.
Care if I jump in?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so there's a couple things there that were I wouldn't call it technical jargon, but just a place meaning the spot you want them to go. So a place board is usually what you would use. It's literally a square or circle, whatever shape, but it's a thing that they go sit on or go lay down on. And you tell them place, they're supposed to go to it. And to translate it to you for duck hunting, that would be
your blind,
mm-hmm. your dog stand. If you're field hunting, they're field blind. When you're duck hunting and ducks are coming and your dog's, you know, you've been petting your dog or whatever, you tell them place. They run over there and sit down real quick.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you want.
Yeah, sure.
Yep. So place is really important to me for a variety of reasons, but I utilize it a lot in my house. So all of my client dogs and all of my personal dogs go to place, which is just a defined area where they need to stay put. So usually it has defined edges. So like a board or a cot that's elevated off the ground, they're going to be less likely to leave it versus just having them lay down in an undefined area on the ground. So I utilize that because it's great for building impulse control. So unlike putting them in the crate, which I do a lot of, a crate has a defined boundary. So whether or not they choose to get out of it, they can't. But if you put them on place, they have the option to get off of it or not. So if you constantly put them back, whether you're using e-collar or just continuing to reward them back on place, it becomes, they become responsible for themselves. So they get to make the decision of whether or not to leave place, and that will build impulse control. So if I leave place, for me, what that is it's vibrate until they're back on once they understand the expectations. So they have that option to leave, but if they build that impulse control that if I stay put, I don't feel vibrate and I can be reinforced with food. And that really comes into play with we joke that place is the duct tape of the dog training world. It'll fix anything. So it's a mutually exclusive behavior. So if they're on place, they can't be countersurfing. If they're on place, they can't be jumping on people coming in the house. If they're on place, they can't be chewing up your shoe. So I utilize Place a lot for not only creating a great off switch in these high energy bird dogs that may not settle on their own, but I use it to prevent naughty behavior as well.
That's great.
Yeah, I think this is an excellent explanation of Place.
Yeah, I think so too. All right, we had gear. We did the Garmin.
Yes.
We did the clicker.
Yep.
Those are the ones that I've read about that you use. Is there anything that I'm missing? That's because the two explanations that you've just given were super good, super helpful, really, in terms of me learning something. And is there something else for a quasi beginner that you think like this is another piece of gear or another idea or concept that you must, like the Holy Grail, the Ten Commandments?
I don't know that there's the Holy Grail. You know, something that I utilize a ton for me personally as a trainer is the prong collar. I think it's pretty revolutionary for a lot of people. There's the kind of the stigma that it's, you know, some medieval kind of device, but really there's nothing. The prong is so fantastic. So unlike what we would typically refer to as like a choke collar, you know, something like that, it gets indefinitely tighter. The prong collar does not get indefinitely tighter. The prong collar, in my opinion, is really effective because it allows you to finesse heel walking. So a lot of people, that's the number one complaint I get, is I can't walk my dog on a leash. And of course, people have these bird dogs in suburbia and they're dying to go out running. But the prong collar applies really finessed kind of pressure that doesn't get indefinitely tighter. So you don't have to worry about, you know, using it inappropriately. You absolutely can, but it's meant to be a finessing tool. So it can really improve your heel walking with a lot less effort. So you definitely need to know how to use it properly, but it can be game changing. So, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, I haven't been able to walk my dog in months. It's been stuck in my backyard. And you put a prong collar on it and you show them how to move away from the pressure, and you have a beautiful, lovely heel walk in just a short amount of time. So it's one of the undervalued tools, in my opinion, that can be really, really helpful. So I teach all my dogs to heel using a prong collar, and then I may or may not overlay e-collar pressure so that they could have an off-leash heel or no longer need the prong. But if I'm just taking my personal dogs for a walk, a lot of times I'll just throw the prong collars on them. That way I'm not worrying about remotes for multiple dogs. It's a tool that I really, really utilize a lot.
Is there like a time period where you use the prong collar and then you've reinforced good heel walking and then you can switch back and it resonates, or is it something that you constantly have to bring back just to reinforce it over time? And if you don't use it regularly, then
So that's a great question. So heel, in my opinion, is one of the things people struggle the most with, and if you don't have a tool that works for you, you're going to continue to struggle. So I pretty much never recommend that people heel in like a flat collar and leash, because it's, you know, especially most flat collars nowadays, whether they're 1 inch thick or whatever, it's, you know, it's, there's no disadvantage for a dog pulling into it. You know, there's no reinforcement that they shouldn't be doing that. So for me, I always heel in a prong collar or an e-collar. That way, if a dog starts to pull, I can correct that behavior and prevent them from pulling, essentially. Whereas if you use the prong and then go to a flat collar and they see a squirrel and they go to chase that, you've done nothing to correct that behavior, because the pulling can be actually quite reinforcing in a flat collar, because it the opposition reflex of having that big, thick, big, thick, flat collar to pull into. And then it goes downhill quickly from there. Once they start pulling, then you're kind of in a mess. So, you know, even with my older dogs who heel very nicely, I'm always using a prong or a flat collar or a slip lead, but never, a prong or an e-collar or a slip lead, but never just a flat collar, because I don't want them to have the opportunity to learn that it can be good for them to pull.
Is there a time period where it's too late?
No, absolutely not, ever.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that.
This has all been super.
So we'll send everyone a bill for Healing 101.
Seriously.
Shortly after, Sam's going to get a fat bill today.
Yeah, I know, seriously. Oh, my God.
Dude.
Okay, I've got another one.
Yeah, I know you do.
Are you ready?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, raw feeding.
Yes.
Okay, this is super cool to me.
Yeah.
Talk about it.
Okay, so I feed my dogs raw, which means they eat literally raw meat. it's way more than, I just had to say this, it's way more than just like giving them a chicken quarter or something like that. So there is a science behind it. For one, it's more biologically available. So just like when we talk about humans, if we eat whole fresh foods, it's going to be better for us than eating highly processed foods. It's going to be more nutrient dense. They're going to be more biologically available, which means our bodies will get more from that nutrition. So it's easier for, you know, to get the nutrients you need out of eating whole foods than the amount of, you know, vitamins you need from eating pizza all day.
So, yeah, sure.
So I feed raw for the health benefits, which are quite a few. For one, you know, there's the obvious that they're going to get the nutrition that they need in a easier, more biologically appropriate way. But it's also lower in carbs and starches, which is a huge problem with food, in my opinion. So when we look at things like kibble, they have to have binding agents for it to hold that little round shape when it's processed. So then you get a lot of carbs and starches, which makes it stick together and keep that shape. And a lot of those are going to help make it shelf stable as well. And those are not designed to be good for our pets. They're designed to make it so that it stays together and so that it's shelf stable. So that's not because they benefit our dogs, but because they benefit convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, in a naturally occurring canine diet, you're looking at, I believe it's like 5 to 8% carbs and starches. Whereas in most kibbles, it's going to be anywhere from like 40 to 80%. And so when we think about what carbs and starches are, they're sugars. And so just like we know from humans, sugars do a lot of bad things. You don't get anything good from excess sugar. So that's where I think a lot of problems start with in dogs, from them being overweight to potentially cancer to teeth issues.
Skin. I see a lot of skin problems.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So many skin problems. And so that's kind of how I got into raw feeding. I have a blue pit bull who has all sorts of health issues.
Great bird dog.
Oh, fantastic bird dog. She'd love to be a bird dog. But, you know, she's blue, so she's that dilute color, which always comes with skin problems. So her name's Pinky, and she was a foster failure, but she came with that name, and she used to be pretty pink, you know, her whole belly and paws and face and ears, everything was pink. And then I switched her to raw and she turned white. It was quite surprising that I'd had her for years and she'd been pink this whole time. And it was actually inflammation.
Yeah,
it felt awful, but starches lead to inflammation. And so when I switched her to raw, you know, her yeast cleared up, her skin problems cleared up, her skin turned a totally different color. So that was kind of my selling point on feeding raw in the benefits. And, you know, the real reason why I switched is that I had trouble keeping weight off of her, and she has ligament issues, and I was barely feeding her any kibble. But I switched her to raw, and she went from 63 pounds to 48 pounds over winter. So it was almost immediately, and she's actually eating more because it's a lot of raw is moisture, so she gets to eat more, and I don't have to feel like I'm starving her, but she's able to keep the weight off a lot better. And so I feed Blitz, my hunting dog, my GSP, raw as well. She eats significantly more, you know, because she burns a lot of it, but her condition is fantastic. She always looks super great. Her coat's shiny and all that, but she's got a great muscle tone, and her teeth look fantastic. You know, she's 3, and my pit bull is almost 8, and they both have really great teeth, which is a huge problem for dogs. A lot of dogs have dental disease from kibble.
I've got a question. So actually, I've got all the questions.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, go for it.
So I've got my wife has a rescue Weimaraner who has severe allergies to starches and really everything. I'm assuming that was one of the reasons she was originally put up for adoption, and a couple temperament issues. But anyway, she, our veterinarian, who is a bird hunter and a friend, and I trust him very much, he switched the dog over to a hydrolyzed diet. And I don't know how familiar you are with
not
that.
Not super familiar.
So it's dog food and it's rawest form, but it's still dog food, but it's not high in protein. It's not high in anything.
Interesting.
So I wonder if switching her to a raw diet would do the same thing, because what it did, she has severe skin issues in her ears, and anytime, like, I'm talking about one bite of my other dog's food, which is, I mean, it's quality food. I mean, we're feeding ProPlan. It's, if you're going to buy dog food, it's good stuff. One bite, and she's got skin right. inflammation outbreaks, yep. floppy ear problems, and yep. I'm curious about that. So, where are you getting your raw food for one?
Okay, so
yeah, I
make my own.
Okay,
But it's very, very important. It's absolutely critical that you balance it, which means you cannot just feed whatever you want and call it good. So, mm-hmm. As most kibble is set to AFCO standards, which means it contains the appropriate amount of nutrients based on the NRC, the National Research Council's guidelines of what a food needs to contain in order to meet minimal nutrient requirements. So people that don't like raw, which are a lot of people, a lot of the arguments against raw is that it's not balanced, and that can be very true.
Sure.
So again, if you're feeding your dog rice and chicken quarters, that is not balanced, and you will have health problems from that for sure. So I feed DIY raw, which means I make it myself, but I follow raw recipes that I've had made by a nutritionist who has plugged all the numbers in and has made sure that they meet the NRC's guidelines for minimum nutrient requirements. So what that looks like is a huge variety and a lot of kind of weird things. So like, for instance, in general, I'll feed raw meaty bones that are safe to be eaten. So we never, ever feed cooked bones of any right. kind, but a lot of poultry bones are safe. No weight-bearing bones for big animals, so sure. no legs or such, but you can feed, pork ribs are fine. But
Raw pork ribs are fine.
Yep, and so anything really? That really comes from chicken and turkeys is fine. So
sure, they can crush those.
Waterfowl. Yeah.
Yep, so I do feed a lot of
I saw a picture. Well. I saw a picture on your social media, and it had a head of a greenhead.
Yes.
In uh-huh. the bowl.
Yeah, so I'm lucky that I have hunting friends who give me their duck heads. I feed those, which is a great source of fur and feathers.
Whole.
Yeah, yep.
Okay, so. My brother's on the – I was criticizing my brother a bit with his dog. He's on the right track. Okay. So, I'll tell you more about that later.
So yeah, so in general what I'm getting at is you have to feed a balanced diet. And the only way you can verify that it's balanced is by when someone plugs in the numbers to make sure it meets the NRC guidelines. So another popular way to feed raw is what's called a ratio diet, which is 80-10-10, 80% meat, 10% liver, and then 10% bone and then 10% liver and organ, which is usually 5 and 5. That's considered a ratio diet, and it's very popular. And if you provide enough variation, a lot of people feed that, but you're not 100% sure that you're meeting all your dog's nutrient requirements. So, for instance, my dog gets oysters for zinc. And so if I'm out of oysters right now, so I'm feeding a zinc pill to replace that zinc for oysters. So, oysters don't typically come to mind when you think about feeding your dog. Yeah. So it's really important that you have a balanced recipe to make sure you're feeding the appropriate levels of vitamins, minerals, and, everything has to be in balance. Like your copper and zinc should be balanced to a ratio as well. So just meeting the minimums is not good enough. So it's very mathematical, and that's why it's important to not just.
Yeah, it sounds like if you're hearing this and you're like, oh, I'm just going to kill a deer and I'm never buying dog food
exactly.
again.
Exactly.
Like no, it sounds like that's not, that. Yeah, that's not what no, you need to do.
Absolutely not.
You need to get with an expert such as Emily.
I am not an expert.
But I feel like someone needs to call someone who has done this successfully for a number of years yep. and get their technique yep. because this is a lot of work.
Yeah. So I have a blog post on my website called, is it called Raw 101, I believe? And in that, I link to all my favorite resources. Okay. So there are a variety of nutritionists who know what they're doing that will make balanced recipes for you based on what you have access to. But again, never will it just be, I'm going to just feed, you know, chicken and peas or some of the weird things you see online. That is not balanced, and that is, you are way better off to feed kibble than to feed unbalanced.
So, go ahead.
Dude, let me have a few. You've been hogging it, dude.
I want it, but I'll give it to you.
All right. So, okay. Oh, my goodness. First, so I've dabbled with feeding raw, and done a lot of research on it. And a lot of folks like to grind. Mm-hmm. Is that something? So you're feeding whole raw.
Yes. And so, like, there's really no reason to grind it unless you have a dog, like, without teeth.
Sure, an old dog. Okay.
Because there are benefits to feeding it unground for teeth purposes. So, I feed a lot of turkey necks, which are great for cleaning teeth. And, you know, the dogs have no issues whatsoever breaking those down. So unless you have a dog that you're having some serious like choking issues with or bad teeth or something like that, there's really no need to grind it.
So that brings up my next question. So feeding whole, I would never, ever feed my duck dogs, a whole duck head, because that is encouraging them to eat my ducks in the blind.
I get that a lot.
So I'm blown away that this is something that you're recommending. So I can't wait to hear what you're doing.
So for one, I think it's a huge difference in context. So there are many people who feed whole prey. And what that means is it's a whole animal and it's perfectly balanced the way it is. Because
if you give some
So oftentimes it'll be small game so that it's, you know, manageable in one meal, such as a lot of people feed whole quail and a lot of people feed whole prey rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a whole animal. It's perfectly balanced that way because that's how they would eat it in the wild. And so that's a very easy way of feeding raw. And some people feed exclusively like that. For me, I don't feed that. I don't feed my dogs whole quail. For one, you'd be surprised how many dogs will not eat it.
Yeah, they don't like the feathers.
No. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially for a dog that's grown up on, like, kibble or something, you kind of have to starve them a little bit in order to make them want to eat a whole bird. So my dogs have no problems eating duck heads, but they're chopped off duck heads that come in their bowl at mealtime. I've never once had my dog who's eaten so many duck heads ever attempt to eat.
I need to introduce you to my dog.
If you have a problem with it, you know, no need to feed it, but you obviously have access to a lot of them.
Well, I mean, I wish I had access to a lot. I mean, a few.
Well, if you need help taking care of them, I would gladly take any duck heads.
Keep that in mind. Yeah. No, I think that's, it's fascinating. And I know Grayson's got a squirrel dog too. So you've met.
Kind of.
Okay. Well, I had a really good squirrel dog growing up, like very good.
Okay.
And the only problem was I didn't know anything about training dogs. I was a kid and this dog came out of the box knowing how to hunt squirrels, you know? So I had no idea, but this dog thought that all squirrels were his. When you shot a squirrel, good luck.
Yeah.
If he beat you to it, good luck getting that squirrel home for dinner. I actually bought a tie-out lead that was half leather, half chain to clip the dog to a tree so he would not chew through the lead to get the squirrel and have to pry each squirrel out of his mouth because he could almost swallow them whole.
Oh, wow.
And so that was like many years later when I was – you know, my dad always had dogs, but when I was getting my own bird dogs and starting from scratch with my own dogs, one lesson I remembered was don't let them eat it. Don't let them eat what I'm trying to hunt. Because with that squirrel dog, I thought, oh yeah, I'm gonna let him eat this and he'll be good. But he was different because my brother, he's got squirrel dog, feeds him squirrel heads, and the dog just munches them right down.
Yep.
So I guess it's just like if you start them when they're a puppy and teach them that this is when you can and this is when you can't.
Yep, I think context is super important. Yeah. But I personally have never had any issue.
I'm fascinated.
And you know, I've fed a lot of duck heads, and my dog's retrieved a lot of ducks from training scenarios.
And never chewed the head off before it brought it to
never,
you.
Never. I mean, she'll kill it.
Yeah.
She loves to kill a duck, but she doesn't even like pluck feathers or anything like
no
that.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, that's.
So she's also had a formal retrieve. Mm-hmm. So if she did something like that, what would I do? As I would reinforce, no, you need to hurry up and bring that back to me.
That's right.
So, you know, I have that on my side. That's why I'm never worried about it, because I know I can always fix it if it ever popped up. But it's never been a problem.
That's fascinating.
All right,
Sam, you can have some.
Thank you. God. I've been waiting. Okay, I'm just going to kind of go through some products that I might or Cody might have on hand, and you tell me yeah or no as a potential food source in raw. So duck heads, obviously, duck necks, duck legs.
Yep.
Duck legs are good.
Yep.
Guts.
So you want to feed the organs. Mm-hmm. So like heart is a good one to feed from ducks. The other organs are going to not be easy. Like, you know, feeding a duck lung is going to be a little bit silly.
Sure. Yeah.
The intestines, that's a general no.
Yeah.
So just to clear up some things, in general, you can feed heart, lung, liver, kidney, pancreas. I'm probably forgetting. Ovaries and testes are an important part of that. I do feed brain from pork. So those are all good to go from any meat source. But what I will say is if you're going to feed wild game, you need to freeze it for 3 weeks.
Thank you.
Freeze it for 3 weeks before feeding. Things that are for sure off limits are carnivores. We never, ever feed carnivores. You never feed wild boars.
Feed carnivores to other
carnivores. You hear that? Never feed wild pig.
Yep.
Wild pig's a big no.
Yeah. Anything that carries trichinosis.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
So grocery store pork is fine.
Yep.
Not wild boar.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And what else? Anything that has additives. So in general, sodium level 200 milligram per 4 ounces, I believe, is what's recommended. Anything less than that's fine. So just be careful. Like with some pork at the store, it'll be too high in sodium and such. But anything with additives. So obviously we are not going to feed sausage or anything
bacon.
Like
yeah,
that.
We're not giving them sodium nitrate.
No bacon.
How about this? Let's say I shoot a deer.
Yes.
And I go through the process, and I've got it on the stainless steel table, and I'm working like a shank. And obviously, I'm going to have things. You've always got those those connective tissues, mm-hmm. tallow, things that you're not putting into a prime grind pile.
Unless you're making candles.
Yeah, unless you're making candles. But you've got, obviously, you're going to have some meat that comes with that as well. Yep. You can't get all of it. So you've got maybe a 40% meat to 60% ligament and tallow combination. Mm-hmm. Is that usable as well?
Yeah, so you just obviously want to watch your fat content. So some dogs are less tolerant to fat than others. And in general, if you're feeding a balanced recipe, it's going to be set up for fat. So like if I'm going to feed something super fatty, I always feed it with a lean meat too, such as venison.
Mm-hmm.
So I balance that out. The worst that's going to happen is you're going to have some cannon butt going on, but it's not the end of the world. But typically what I like to do is if friends and family will kill a deer, I'll take the carcass and scrape everything I absolutely can off of it and feed that. So they'll give me shoulders and stuff where you're not going to get a lot of meat off for human consumption, and I'll feed all of that. With deer, obviously you want to be careful of CWD and never feed deer heads. So you can feed pig heads. So if you have a friend that's harvesting a pig, you can certainly feed the head. But deer, you want to obviously avoid the head and spinal cord. And again, no weight-bearing joints, so I wouldn't allow them to...
Yeah, femurs and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you can let them chew the meat off of that, but you got to be careful to take away at the appropriate time.
I'm real nervous about deer bones and my domestic dogs in that they do tend to break in shards a lot of times. They get brittle, especially if they've been outside for any amount of time.
Yeah. I don't feed any deer bones.
Yep. I wanted to point that out. I knew you would.
I'm super cautious about things. My older dog has pretty fragile teeth from all the time I let her eat Nyla bones and antlers when she was younger. And so her teeth have got some chips in them. So I'm very cautious about what I feed her. But for the most part, I do not feed big bones like that. I don't even feed a lot of people feed deer ribs, which are fine, but I do not.
Yeah, those my dogs don't get those. I get those. I feed those to me. That's a good question.
Because there's a ton of, I would say, waste.
Absolutely.
You do your darndest.
Don't say waste. Something's eating it.
Yeah, I know, but you do your darndest to get as much usable meat as you can. But I think about going into a shank or something and getting a muscle group out, and it's got the striations of connective tissue, and you're using your fillet knife to get that connective tissue out, but you're losing meat. You know, a lot is going into a pile.
Yep.
You clean your deer, you got that pile that you got pushed over to the side, and there is red, dark red, usable meat
for sure
in there
that you can't extract.
That you can't extract
to put in exactly. something else because it's just not going to work.
Yeah,
yep, I would absolutely feed that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So you know that's what I post on like local Facebook groups and stuff, that if anyone harvests a deer and whatever you're not going to use, I'll take, you know, with the exception of pretty much intestines. I love when I get hunters who don't want the heart and lungs and until kidneys.
Until I get a dog, I'll get your number.
Okay.
Yeah, I wish I would have known. I was, I use it to bait coyotes. So
yeah,
some of it, so when I'm fleshing hides, all that scrap is my dog treats. Like, all that scrap goes mm-hmm. to the dogs because it's really clean. It's got a lot of – it's got gristle and meat, so it's great supplement to their dog food. But, I'm not scraping meat off the spinal column and the hips.
Right.
I probably will now, especially now that you're telling me that boiling it or any type of cooking, it's not necessary as long as I freeze it,
yep.
which is what I thought. I've always thought that, but I've always been afraid to test it out on my own dogs. So you've been testing it. How long have you been doing this?
2017, so 3 years.
And no dogs are dying.
No one's dying.
Actually, they're looking better and better.
Yes, for sure.
You around Sunday?
I might be. We'll see.
I'm processing the deer. Okay. I'll keep some scraps.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, 3 weeks. 3 weeks in the freezer. I think take that away and all the things concerning disease and don't feed predators. Yep. That's good.
When it comes to birds, small, you know, doves or mm-hmm. ducks in a lot of cases with a small duck. I mean, you get, sometimes I'll cook duck legs. I'm going to be honest. Sometimes I don't. I mean, there's meat there that it's not worth the time for me.
Yep.
But I feel guilty about it sometimes.
Yep.
And it's good to know
that I can get a use. You might find that your dogs aren't interested in it. A lot of my, a lot of dogs are not, I don't know any dogs that have a problem with venison, but there are a lot of dogs that won't eat bird.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But, you know, like another thing I feed on occasion is freezer burnt meat. So when meat's freezer burnt, usually the big reason why we don't eat it is because of texture. So it's still fine for dogs to eat. So I have a lot of friends who clean out their freezers and they'll give me their freezer burnt venison and their freezer burnt birds that they've cleaned for eating. And my dogs will eat those in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
So like, you know, a quail that still has the chest and everything, they'll eat that. But sometimes they're a little bit weird about duck. And
yeah, I hope to not have any freezer burnt meat.
Yeah,
that's the goal.
That's not a problem.
Yeah, that shouldn't be a problem.
That's not been
for
a problem in my house, maybe ever, unless I. We ate a matter of fact. You guys came over to the house and we ate a backstrap from. This was last year.
4 years old.
It was older than that. It was seven.
Oh,
it was 7 years
wow.
old.
It's pretty good.
It was an experiment because I had found it. Like, it was one of those freezer
yep.
fossils, you know.
Yep.
Found it, and it's like, we're going to cook this thing and see what
nice.
It's like. It was perfectly fine.
Mm, yeah,
is that the oldest meat you've ever eaten?
Seven. Yeah, 7 years.
Seven. Yeah. Seven's pretty old.
Seven was, as old as it's ever been for me.
Last year,
by a long ways.
I found some deer burger in the bottom of my freezer, and I cooked it for my buddy. Yeah. And I happened to look at the pack date after he was already chewing on it. It's 2010.
Mm.
Yeah, that's old.
So, nine plus years.
Yeah, I wouldn't do grind that old. This was a whole muscle.
So I didn't do it on purpose.
This was a loin. A loin. Not much that can go wrong there.
Yeah. Okay, raw. That was, I'm glad I brought that up. That was awesome.
We've never talked about anything like that on this podcast before. So that was, I think that the folks listening will definitely maybe be utilizing a little more of their deer harvest,
yeah.
if nothing else.
So as a general rule, so we talked a lot about balance and not just feeding random things, but as a general rule, if you're feeding less than 20% of your dog's diet in raw, and which would be easy to calculate in calories especially, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be balanced.
That's what I was wondering.
So if it's less than 20%, you can add, you know, just venison scraps or whatever. But other great options to add are whole eggs. So especially mm-hmm. not the ones from the grocery store. You can feed those. Don't feed the shell. But if you're going to add eggs, if you can find farm fresh eggs, feed the shell and everything, that's perfectly balanced. You can do that up to like an egg a day.
Dang, Sam.
I'm going to have to do that. I'm going to have to get the chickens back. Yep.
And then fish is another great option. Yep. So sardines in particular, or mackerel, there's, you know, be careful with mercury levels. But sardines are whole, so you can feed as much of those as you want.
How do you feel about, like, large fish bones? So if I catch a limit of crappie and I fillet the main part for me, what's the harm in throwing the remainder to my dog?
What I would probably do is just feed the head.
Just the head.
And again, freeze it for 3 weeks.
Okay.
They're not going to get obviously anything out of the bone or the, you know, the mm-hmm. back, but keep in mind that it's not balanced that way.
Yep. So I'm just like as that. A supplement.
Yeah.
But yeah, as long as I freeze it, they won't get worms and we're good to go.
Freeze it and feed less than 20% of their diet.
Good to know. My dog's been known to munch a fish head.
That was awesome.
Yeah, that was hugely informative for any. You didn't have to have a, that's not just for hunting dogs. This is for dogs.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, they're the kin to wolves. So
yep.
Feed your. I was thinking when you were saying, you know, all these animals and these parts that you're like feeding whole. I was like, it's gonna be like going to feed my tigers. I'm pulling a Joe Exotic.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been in some weird situations.
You're getting Joe Exotic close there,
Brian. If you fall for that, ladies and gentlemen, you're worse than a bunch of nuts in a squirrel tree.
When it comes to organ meat, and you were talking about the 80-10-10, you said the organ meat was split into five. So you said heart and then?
5% liver, 5% other secreting organs.
Okay.
So that's kidney, spleen, pancreas, brain, testes and ovaries are what's considered secreting organs. So that's for a ratio diet. So for my balanced recipes, all I feed is pork brain, pork liver, and pork kidney. For my one dog, my other dog's recipe is mostly beef spleen. So it really depends on the recipe you're feeding to make sure you meet those nutrient requirements. But in general, that's the ratio is a standard outline.
And the secreting organs of venison would, or of deer would be good as well.
Yep. But you just have to keep in mind that if you're not following a recipe, that you would want to provide a lot of variation.
Yeah.
So feeding just venison kidney is not going to probably meet all your nutrient requirements, sure. Even if you are at the 5% mark.
But if you harvest, I mean, think about you harvest those organs and you put them in a pile and you're looking for 5% out of those secreting organs for a meal over time, you could make those organs off of one deer go a pretty long way. And you put all those secreting organs, cut them up into small pieces, push them into a pile, mix them up, and then you've got a wide variety of organ meat with a lot of different nutrients coming off of one deer that could last you, you know, you shot five deer. Think about how much organ meat you could have.
That's probably way more than enough for one dog if you're going to
include
variation for other organs as well or other species.
That's interesting. Yeah, those things I haven't thought about. The whole, what caught me the most and what reminded me of the Joe Exotic thing the most was when you got into feeding whole animals. Like, I was like, whoa. I don't think I'm ever going to toss my dog a whole rabbit.
I don't feed a lot of whole prey, but if the opportunity arises, I have a friend with a Vizsla who very often brings back wild rabbits, and she feeds raw, so she throws them in the freezer, and there's food for a day.
That's crazy.
Would you feed less often, right? You would not feed every day if you were feeding whole animals, correct?
It depends. So it depends on the size of the animal.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you're feeding like, you know, a meal that's going to last you long enough for a couple of days, you could fast them for a day or so. But in general, it's not like, you know, they're eating enough to skip a couple of days.
I gotcha. Okay. Let's move on.
Yeah. While we got a pause here,
let's
talk Rock Outdoors real quick. I know you have something to say.
Well, if you're trying to get a hold of whole animals to feed your dogs, you should stop at Rock Outdoors first and gear up. I think that's especially for fishing. If you're going to feed some fish heads to your dogs, Rock Outdoors is going to help you catch those fish. I mean, I don't know the square footage of that store, but there's a lot.
Oh, it's big.
There's a lot in there. There's more than I could talk about in just a little short commercial, but they've got everything from men's undergarments to fishing gear, boats, and
camping gear,
high-end camping gear, which is kind of hard to find. locally. We don't have an REI super close by, and I don't know why you would need one with Rock Outdoors right down the road.
Yeah, sure. Where are they?
Highway 8, Lexington.
Thank you. All right, let's move on.
All right.
Fitness. Let's talk fitness.
Okay.
Of your dogs. Before we got on air, she's like, let me be clear. When we're talking about fitness, we're not talking about me. We're talking about the dogs.
So, she told you that? Yeah. Where was I at when she said that?
Just to be clear.
I saw your dogs, videos of your dogs in a treadmill, underwater treadmill.
Yes.
Working.
What?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So this is like, it made me think of the Rocky movie where, like, you
where
know,
he runs up the stairs.
Well, I was thinking, like, your dogs are like Rocky, like working out in the woods, like lifting logs,
pounding on pigs.
Yeah. And then her dogs are like the Russian, who's like in the gym with the highest technology, like getting like
this is factual.
Her dogs are getting absolutely shredded,
and my dogs have the least amount of resources at their disposal. Okay,
no, your dogs are great. Everybody's dogs are wonderful. Rocky won that fight, but but your dogs are working with some serious equipment.
So yeah, that was pre-COVID. I haven't been doing that so much since then, but I really do love the water treadmill, and I've been pretty interested in canine fitness for a while. So I do a lot of stuff at home, which is super simple. I have little balance pods that you buy for humans, which is great for building muscle, and I do a lot of different type of exercises, such as position changes from like a down to a sit or a sit to a stand. There's lots of different ways you can utilize just things at home in order to build fitness, but the water treadmill is really freaking cool. And I used to do that on a bi-weekly basis just to maintain fitness level, but I think it's really important, especially for athletes, so, you know, hunting dogs who, according to my Whistle app, which tracks, you know, GPS tracks, blitz can go anywhere from like 25 to 30 miles a day hunting. And so I think it's really important that we keep our dogs fit for that in order to prevent injuries. So especially in the off season or, you know, during the week on rainy days, I do a lot of different kinds of activities like that using balance pods or feed buckets and just all sorts of little things to do different kinds of exercises to help keep both my dogs actually fit. You know, my pit bull has a ligament injury, so she pre-COVID was doing water treadmill and such too in order to keep herself strong as well.
I've stolen so much of your intellectual property today that I'm going to cut it off there. If you want to know more about fitness and how to get your dogs shredded like that Russian in the Rocky movies, you need to not hear it here, and you need to go to her website and call her.
Yeah, you need to get up with Emily, short hairs and shotguns, and before we get off here, we're going to say every single way that people can get a hold of you. But before we do that, I've got a couple of questions since Sam took most of the invoice is going to him. So obviously you hunt because you've got hunting dogs and you're into hunting. Did that start when you got hunting dogs, or was that something you did before? Which came first, the dog or the hunting?
The dog definitely came first.
Okay.
So when I got my Blitz, who's my German Shorthair Pointer, I had no intentions to hunt. I was just looking for a high-energy, high-drive, working dog. At that time, I was just a pet obedience trainer, lived on a farm, had horses, wanted a dog that could keep up with my lifestyle and kind of be what we call a demo dog for, you know, doing cool things to as far as a pet obedience trainer would need. And I had looked into hunting breeds, knowing that they would be, you know, more higher drive and have really great work ethics compared to some, you know, show bred dogs, for lack of a better term. And so I had found a local breeder who bred really impressive hunting dogs, and he was only an hour away from me at the time. So every week I'd go and hang out with him and the puppies, and he slowly kind of talked me into doing a little bit of hunting stuff. You know, he phrased it as, it doesn't take a lot of training and experience, it just takes some exposure for dogs like this. And, you know, so that was kind of appealing. And so I had picked Blitz up in September. In October, there was a NAVDA event, And I went down there and saw that just to kind of see what it was about and was really impressed watching the dogs work. And I had never hunted with dogs before. I'd never been hunting, but I'd never hunted with dogs before. And so even though, you know, that's a test and it's kind of a contrived situation, it's not real hunting, it was really cool to watch those dogs work. Right. And I was super hooked from there. And then so when I brought Blitz out and got to do bird things with her and realized how much she, how natural it was to her and how much she enjoyed it, I mean, there's really no going back after seeing that. So it started with accidentally kind of getting interested in it. And then once I was doing all this training with her for hunting related things, I eventually took her actually hunting, and watching her point her first wild bird, you know, kind of sold me on it.
Sure. Well, who wouldn't be sold on it?
Right.
Yeah. Well, the reason I asked that is, and in our jobs, we deal with folks who are either very much advocates of hunting, or they don't care either way. They're on the fence, which is the majority of the American public, or they're adamantly opposed to hunting. And I would assume that you were probably one of those Americans who was could care less either way.
Yep.
You obviously aren't a vegan.
Yep.
And so you didn't have a problem with it, but you didn't, you know, you didn't care to go or not go till you got this dog and you saw how much enjoyment she got out of it. Or he, is it he or she?
She
got out of it, and then, you know, that trickled right down to you.
For sure.
So I think that's interesting. I found that a lot of younger bird hunters, that's how they've gotten into it. It was the dog came first.
Yep. And it's still for me very much about her. So, you know, people ask me to go hunting with them, and if I'm not bringing my dog, I really don't care to go.
You and I are on the same page there.
You know, if, you know, everyone's like, how many birds did you kill? I'm a horrible shot. It's never about that for me. You know, I'll bring my gun and I'll pretend like I know what I'm doing, but it's absolutely about the dogs for
me. It would be a lie if I said it wasn't a little bit about that for me. But seriously, though, for me, it is about my dogs getting that more exposure. The more exposure they get, the better they get.
Absolutely.
And just the gratitude and enjoyment I get out of seeing a dog that I formed their mental state and what they're doing, and see them succeed, that's a reward.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm with you. Like, if somebody invites me to go, but they're like, well, I'm going to bring my dog, you know, I really don't care to go.
Yep,
I mean,
I get
it's rude, maybe, but, you know, if I wasn't taking my dogs, I wouldn't go.
Right. That's why I do it.
Yep. I agree with you. So that trickles into my next question. Conservation, which is what our podcast is mainly about. And it's about a lot of things. We have all kinds of guests on here, but every one of them, and we talk about it all the time, we all fit under this conservation umbrella, no matter what type of person you are, how you get involved in the outdoors. And obviously you started out, you know, you're already involved in the outdoors through your lifestyle with horses. I mean, nobody's got horses indoors. But, you know, conservation and horses, they go together in that you need places to ride.
For sure.
And if you're trail riding and that kind of thing. But with dogs, and especially hunting dogs, it really gets into conservation, because hunters were the first conservationists and they continue to be the leading conservationists. How have you, when you get into the bird dog world and then you get into the hunting with bird dog world, you find out that there's really not that many birds.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, wow, I just found out about this and I'm 50 years too late.
That's exactly right.
So, you know, tell us your thoughts on that, because I know you've got some.
Yeah. So again, seeing my dog point her first wild bird was kind of one of those moments that kind of changes things for you. As many hen-raised birds as she's, you know, found and pointed and will continue to do so, nothing quite, you know, compares to watching them find and point wild birds. And, you know, I recently lived in Person County, North Carolina, and my neighbor grew up on our street, and, you know, knowing that I had bird dogs, we'd talk about hunting a lot, and he would tell me stories of how when he was young, he couldn't get home fast enough to go grab a shotgun, and without even dogs would
move coveys of quail.
Five or so coveys, you know, a casual day after school.
Yeah, those guys make me sick.
And it's, you know, hearing that from someone who I've seen, you know, a handful of wild coveys in Kansas, and it's just like, are you kidding me? Like, and, you know, it's a little bit Well, for it's super sad and depressing, but it's a little bit, there's definitely a lot of envy there that I'll never experience.
Right, envy, like that's that. What I have. I'm jealous.
I'll never experience something like that in my life. And so what I do have are woodcock, and I appreciate the heck out of that, and I enjoy it so much. And, you know, it's definitely, definitely important that I have those opportunities. You know, I hunt public land, and it's super important to me to have those opportunities to get my dog on wild birds, because nothing, there's no contrived pen raised scenario that will ever meet that,
right,
meet that kind of opportunity.
That's agreed. And, you know, in our role as conservationists working for the land trust here, we're working, part of our mission is to conserve that habitat, which is the number one reason we don't have the birds that your neighbor had.
Yep.
Because I'm sure he would tell you in those same stories that there were half as many houses on my street there.
For sure.
Or less. Or yep. Maybe he was the only house on the street. And, you know, he's like, that apartment complex over there used to be a field where I would get birds up in, right, every afternoon. You know, we're, North Carolina is one of those states that we're losing farm. We're the second fastest farmland loss in the country.
Wow.
I think that's correct. So we're losing farmland by the hour, and it's terrifying, because with losing farmland, we're losing quail habitat.
Yep.
And with farming practices being what they are today, they're so much more efficient and better. And so because of they're better for humans does not necessarily mean they're better for quail. They're actually much, much worse for quail because they're so clean.
Yep.
A weedy looking farm that's overgrown looks bad to us, yep, with our European eye, but to a quail, that's home.
Yep.
And you don't see that much anymore. So I'm with you. I'm jealous of the guys who grew up in the area. My dad's one of those guys.
Nice.
And, you know, he grew up in the time when he would get home from school and with bird dogs that, you know, we work really hard and you work extremely hard to have a exceptional bird dog.
Yeah.
You know, my dad had bird dogs that he may have trained a little bit, but there were so many wild birds yeah, that
you didn't need to,
and they, yep, were good dogs.
Yep.
You know, so you just had your bird dog that was the dog you got, and you didn't really work with it that much, and you took it out and you hunted it and worked birds. Mm-hmm. Anymore, if you don't have a top-notch dog and a top-notch location, you're not going to find that. Yep. So that's what we do.
And wild birds are pretty critical to, like, as an experience, you know, for your dogs as well. I mean, not, you can think of it selfishly as well. Am I correct in this in saying that the experience and the opportunity provided to your dog in terms of learning and getting that experience of having and finding and flushing or pointing that wild bird is critical to their evolution to becoming an exceptional dog?
Well, for sure. I think that it's hard to have a bad wild bird contact. You could have plenty of horrible, bad pin-raised bird contacts, but it's hard to have a bad wild bird contact. So your dog's always going to learn something from it.
I met a landowner maybe a month or so ago here in downtown Salisbury. I told you about him. Sharpest, just right, old in, doctor.
Easement holder,
yep. And I went to go do my...
Because he was worried about the same thing we're talking about.
Yeah. I went to go do my monitoring report, and he lived right off a major highway in town, in the city limits. And he was a bird dog man and told me about...
And he's 91.
He's 91.
Wow.
He is sharp. God, I wish I had his memory. Very, very sharp. And he was a bird dog man and told me about, you know, coming home from work, coming home from the office, getting his dogs, walking under the bridge across the highway. And in downtown Salisbury, it was all fields and talking about flushing quail like you were talking about. Crazy. And that was his progression over time and seeing what's happened across our state, but even in his own home county, is really why he conserved his property in the first place and why he became an advocate for conservation. And it was through that practice. So,
and a member of the land trust.
A member of the land trust, nice, exactly. So I think that's, you know, it all ties together. Yep. And, you know, it's hard to miss something until it's gone.
Yep.
And unfortunately, we don't have quail, but like you said, we still do have that wild bird opportunity available here, public lands available here.
I will correct you in that we do have quail. We just don't have quail like nearly those boys have.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because Cody's flushed a big covey of quail last year.
Yeah, and, yeah. I found a couple of coveys. No. You're funny.
But that being said, you know, things could always get worse. I hate to be like the doom and gloom guy, but yeah. I think supporting conservation locally and supporting the land trust hopefully we'll keep things where they are and maybe even improving upon our opportunity and the availability of wild birds here, and so that we can continue these amazing traditions and continuing the sport that you love so much. And sure, I've got to learn about the day, because today was a blast for me.
Emily, I got a question for you, just to kind of wrap up. Where do you see short hairs and shotguns going, and where would you like to take it? And then let people know how they can get in touch with you and find you.
That's a great question. Where is it going? You know, I have a real love for the companion gun dogs, and that's where I see myself staying. And I'm getting busier and busier, and I appreciate that. So we'll kind of see how that pans out. But I, you know, what I would hope is more people that can see these dogs be successful pets and house pets and family members, and be really excellent hunting dogs as well. And, you know, kind of make that more of a trend and improve the lives of not only the dogs, but their owners as well, knowing that they can have the best of both worlds. And so if you're interested in that, you can reach me on social media through Instagram, Facebook, my website. My website is shorthairsandshotguns.com. And you can find me at Short Hairs and Shotguns on Instagram and Facebook as well. And you can reach out to me on any of those platforms, and I'll get in touch with you.
And coming soon, mules.
And mules. Short hairs, shotguns, and mules.
Short hairs, shotguns, and mules. That's people need to check you out and see all the, like, we just barely touched on the surface of what you're doing, and some of the things that we found so interesting. And just in this hour and something conversation, I've learned a lot. And,
me too.
And I know Sam, he's got a notepad full of free information that he stole from you.
I'll send you a Venmo request. Yeah,
please
later.
Do. Yeah, please do. Work that I'll out. I'll pay you in scrap, dear meat.
But hey, that's a good gig for me.
Dude, I've been paying people in meat.
I paid his tile guy in hog meat.
No, I didn't pay him entirely in hog meat. That was a bonus. That
so there, is, if you're looking for a good tile man that you and you don't have money, he takes pig meat. Sam can hook you up with that guy.
Oh,
he's actually a sportsman member and super great guy.
He is. Thanks, Micah. Well, Emily, thank you so much for joining us today. And again, we learned so much, and I can't thank you enough for coming on and meeting with us. And I had a ball. And go check her out. Go check out Short Hairs. And please support the Land Trust.
And Short Hairs, and please support the Land Trust. Check that website out.
I kind of abbreviated it.
Short Hairs and Shotguns. Go check out Emily on all the platforms. And then when you get done checking out everything she's got, and you've learned how to feed your dog and got some training tips, you should slide on over to Three Rivers Land Trust, any of our platforms, and support bird conservation. Right?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you're like us, you're riding down the road listening to the podcast on your commute. But when you get to where you're going, don't forget. Like us on Facebook. Check us out at our website, threeriverslandtrust.org. There you can find out about all the events we're putting on, all the conservation work we're doing, how you can get involved, and how you can help. We'd love to meet like-minded individuals and get you involved in conservation. Till next time.